the most beautiful virgin in the land to be taken within the first season after her moon had flowered. It was her exactly. And then, of course, by casting her as the leading female in the pageant, I had managed to display her to the king in the kindest possible light. What I suddenly realized was about to happen was all of it my fault, as much as though I had deliberately engineered it. What is more, there was nothing I could do about it now. I stood in the sunlight so appalled and stricken with remorse that for a while I was deprived of the powers of speech and of reason. When the sweating priest shoved the hearse off the deck and through the gateway, the crowd around me started after it, and I was borne along with them willy-nilly, as though I were a leaf upon a stream without direction of my own. Before I was able to recover my wits, I found myself within the forecourt of the funerary temple. I began to push my way forward, jostling those ahead of me to get past them, and to reach the side of the hearse before it came to the main entrance of the royal mortuary. As one team of priests pushed the vehicle forward, a second team picked up the wooden rollers that were left behind it and ran forward to place them ahead of the ponderous golden vehicle. There was a short delay as the carriage reached the area of the courtyard that had not yet been paved. While the priests spread straw ahead of the rollers to smooth the passage over this rough ground, I slipped quietly around the back of the row of huge carved stone lions that lined the carriageway and hurried down this clear space until I was level with the ark. When one of the priests tried to bar my way and prevent me reaching the side of the vehicle, I gave him such a look as would have made one of the stone lions quail and spat a single word at him that was seldom heard in the temple confines and caused him to step hurriedly aside and let me pass. When I reached the near side of the ark, I found myself directly below Lostris, close enough to stretch up and touch her arm and to hear every word she addressed to the king. I could tell at once that she had completely recovered her poise, which Pharaoh's unexpected interest in her had disturbed, and was now setting out to be as agreeable as possible to him. Miserably, I recalled how she had planned to do exactly this, and to use his favour to secure his agreement to her marriage to Tanus. As recently as last evening, I had dismissed it as a girlish prattle. But now it was happening, and it was beyond my power to prevent it, or to warn her of the dangerous waters into which she was steering. If earlier in this chronicle I have given the impression that my Lady Lostris was a flighty child, with not a thought in her pretty head other than romantic nonsense and her own frivolous enjoyment of life, then I have fallen short in my efforts as a historian of these extraordinary events. Although still so young, she was at times mature far beyond her years. Our Egyptian girls bloom early in the Nile sunlight. She was also a diligent scholar, with a bright mind and a thoughtful and inquiring side to her nature, all of which I had done my very best over the years to foster and develop. Under my tutelage, she had reached the stage where she could debate with the priests the most obscure religious dogma, could hold her own with the palace lawyers on such matters as the Land Tenure Acts, and the extremely complicated Irrigation Act that regulated the usage of the waters from the Nile. Of course, she had read and absorbed every single one of the scrolls in the palace library. These included several hundred of which I was the author, from my medical treatises to my definitive essays on the tactics of naval warfare, together with my astrological scrolls on the names and natures of all the heavenly bodies, and my manuals on archery and swordsmanship, horticulture and falconry. She could even argue with me my own principles of architecture and compare them to those of the great Imhotep. Thus she was perfectly equipped to discuss any subject from astrology to the practice of war, from politics or the building of temples, to the measurement and regulation of the Nile waters, all of which were subjects that fascinated Pharaoh. In addition, she could rhyme and riddle and coin an amusing pun, and her vocabulary was almost as extensive as my own. In short, she was an accomplished conversationalist, with a ready sense of humour. She was articulate and had an enchanting voice and a merry little laugh. Truly, no man or god could resist her, especially if she could offer to someone without a son the promise of an heir. I had to warn her. And yet how could a slave intrude upon the congress of persons so infinitely high above his own station? I skipped nervously beside the carriage, listening to my Lady Lostris' voice at its most enthralling as she set herself out to engage the king's fancy. She was describing to him the manner in which his funerary temple had been laid out to conform to the most propitious astronomical aspects, those of the moon and the zodiac at the time of Pharaoh's birth. Of course, she was merely repeating knowledge that she had gleaned from me, for I was the one who had surveyed and orientated the temple to the heavenly bodies. However, she was so convincing that I found myself following her explanations as though I was hearing them for the first time. The funeral ark passed between the pylons of the inner court of the temple and rolled down the long colonnaded atrium, past the barred and guarded doors to the six treasuries in which were manufactured and stored the funerary offerings which would go with the king to his tomb. At the end of the atrium, the acacia wood doors, on which were carved the images of all the gods of the pantheon, were swung open, and we entered the mortuary where Pharaoh's corpse would one day be embalmed. Here, in this solemn chapel, the king dismounted from the carriage and went forward to inspect the massive table on which he would lie for the ritual mummification. Unlike the embalming of a commoner, royal embalming took 70 days to accomplish. The table had been sculpted from a single block of diorite, 3 paces long and 2 wide. Into the dark, mottled surface of the stone had been chiselled the indentation that fitted the back of the king's head, and the grooves which would drain the blood and other bodily fluids released by the scalpels and the instruments of the embalmers. The Grand Master of the Guild of Embalmers was standing beside the table, ready to explain the entire process to the king, and he had an attentive audience, for Pharaoh seemed fascinated by every gruesome detail. At one stage it seemed that he might so far forget his dignity as to climb up upon the diorite block and try its fit, very much as though it were a new costume of linen presented by his tailor. However, he restrained himself with an obvious effort, and instead devoted himself to the mortician's description of how the first incision would be made from his gullet to his groin, and how his viscera would be lifted out cleanly, and then divided into their separate parts, liver, lungs, stomach, and entrails. The heart, as the hearth of the divine spark, would be left in place, as would the kidneys with their associations with water, and thus with the Nile, the source of life. After this edifying instruction, Pharaoh minutely examined the 4 canopic jars that would receive his viscera. They stood on another smaller granite table close at hand. The jars were carved from gleaming translucent alabaster, the colour of milk. Their stoppers were fashioned in the shapes of the animal-headed gods. Anubis the jackal, Sobeth the crocodile, Thoth the ibis-headed, Sekhmet with the head of a lioness. They would be the guardians of Pharaoh's divine parts until his awakening in the eternal life. On the same granite table that held the canopic jars, the embalmers had laid out their instruments and the full array of pots and amphorae that contained the natron salts, lacquers, and other chemicals that they would use in the process. Pharaoh was fascinated by the glistening bronze scalpels that would disembowel him, and when the embalmer showed him the long pointed spoon that would be pushed up his nostrils to scoop out the contents of his skull, those cheesy curds over which I had pondered so long and fruitlessly, the king was fascinated and handled the grisly instrument with reverential awe. Once the king had satisfied his curiosity at the mortuary table, my Lady Lostris directed his attention to the painted bas-relief engravings that covered the walls of the temple from floor to ceiling. The decorations were not yet completed, but were nonetheless quite striking in their design and execution. I had drawn most of the original cartoons with my own hand, and had closely supervised the others drawn by the palace artists. These had been traced onto the walls with charcoal sticks. Once the tracings were in place, I had corrected and perfected them in freehand. Now a company of master sculptors was engraving them into the sandstone blocks, while behind them a second company of artists was painting in the completed bas-relief. The dominant colour I had chosen for these designs was blue, in all its variation. The blue of the starling's wing, the blues of the sky and the Nile in the sunlight, the blues of the petals of the desert orchid, and the shimmering blue of the river perch quivering in the fisherman's net. However, there were other colours as well, all those vibrant reds and yellows that we Egyptians love so well. Pharaoh, accompanied closely by my lord Intef, in his capacity of keeper of the royal tombs, made a slow circuit of the high walls, examining every detail and commenting on most of them. Naturally, the theme I had chosen for the mortuary was the Book of the Dead, that detailed map and description of the route to the underworld that Pharaoh's shade must follow, and the depictions of all the trials and dangers he would confront along the way. He paused for a long while before my drawing of the god Thoth, with his bird head and long curved ibis beak, weighing Pharaoh's disembodied heart on the scales against the feather of truth. Should the heart be impure, it would tip the scales against the feather, and the god would immediately toss it to the crocodile-headed monster that waited close at hand to devour it. Softly, the king quoted the protective mantra laid down in the book to shield himself from such a calamity, and then passed on to my next engraving. It was almost noon before Pharaoh had completed his inspection of the mortuary temple and led the way out into the forecourt, where the palace chefs had laid out a sumptuous open-air banquet. "Come and sit here, where I can speak to you further on the matter of the stars." Once again the king ignored precedent to place my Lady Lostrys close to him at the banquet table, even moving one of his senior wives to make a place for her. During the meal, he directed most of his conversation towards my mistress. She was now completely at her ease, and kept the king and all those around her enthralled and merry with her wit and charm. Of course, as a slave, I did not have a seat at the table, nor could I even inveigle myself within range of my mistress to warn her to moderate her demeanour in the king's presence. Instead, I found myself a place on the pedestal of one of the granite lions, from where I could look down the length of the banquet table and watch everything that took place there. I was not the only observer, for my lord Intef sat close to the king, and yet withdrawn, watching it all with glittering, implacable eyes, like a handsome but deadly spider at the centre of his web. At one stage of the meal, a yellow-billed kite wheeled high overhead and uttered a screech, a sardonic and mocking cry. Hurriedly I made the sign against the evil eye, for who knows what god it was that had taken the form of the bird to muddle and confuse our petty endeavours. After the midday meal, it was customary for the court to rest for an hour or so, especially at this the hottest season of the year. However, Pharaoh was so wrought up that today he would have none of it. "Now we will inspect the treasuries," he announced. The guards at the doors of the first treasury stood aside and presented arms as the royal party approached, and the doors were swung open from within. I had planned these six treasuries not only as storerooms to hold the vast funerary treasure that Pharaoh had been collecting for the past 12 years, ever since his accession to the double throne, but also as workshops in which a small army of craftsmen and artisans was permanently employed in adding to that treasure. The hall that we entered was the armory that housed the collection of weapons and accoutrements of the battlefield and the wild chase, both practical and ceremonial, which the king would take with him into the afterworld. With my lord Intef's concurrence, I had arranged for the craftsmen to be at their benches so that the king would have the opportunity of watching them at work. As Pharaoh passed slowly down the row of benches, his questions were so astute and technical that those nobles and priests to whom he addressed himself could provide no answers, and they looked around frantically for someone who could. I was summoned hastily from the back of the crowd and pushed forward to face the king's interrogation. "Ah, yes," Pharaoh grimaced bleakly as he recognized me. "It is none other than the humble slave who writes pageants and cures the sick. No one here seems to know the composition of this electrum wire that binds the stock of the war bow that this man is making for me." "Gracious Pharaoh, the metal is a mixture of one part of copper to five parts of silver and four of gold. The gold is of the red variety found only in the mines of Lot in the western desert. No other gives the wire the same pliability or elasticity, of course." "Of course," the king agreed wryly. "And how do you make the strands so thin? These are no thicker than the hairs of my head." "Majesty, we extrude the hot metal by swinging it in a special pendulum that I designed for the purpose. Later we can watch the process in the gold foundry, if your majesty so wishes." Thus, during the rest of the tour, I was able to remain at the king's side and to deflect some of his attention away from Lostrys, but I still could not find the opportunity to speak to her alone.